This is Anya Leonard, the co-founder of Classical Wisdom, a website dedicated to bringing ancient wisdom to modern minds. And today I'm very happy to be speaking with Professor Michael Fontaine, Professor of Classics and the Associate Vice Provost of Undergraduate Education at Cornell University in New York. Thank you, Michael, for talking to me today.
Thank you. I'm really delighted to be able to speak with you, Anya. Thank you for having me.
Now, you have written quite extensively about mental illness with regards to the ancient world. Maybe we could start off with you giving a little bit of a refresher explanation to our listeners of exactly what mental illness looked like in the ancient world.
Well, that is really what the question is all about. In the ancient world, they didn't really have mental illness in the forms of it that we talk about these things today. And so the question is, why would that happen? So human behaviors are likely to be the same then as they are today, but they didn't have any of the words that we're currently using for mental illness. And that's precisely what got me interested in the topic some years ago, was we throw around these words like depression or schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, that sort of thing. But in the ancient world, they don't have any of those words. And you wonder, how do they conceive of these same behaviors, these same emotions or feelings or attitudes or however you want to characterize them? And so it really depends on where you look in the ancient literature to see what they're going to have to say about mental illness back then. There was a book that came out 3 or 4 years ago. And the editors and the authors of that book went back and they looked at all the ancient medical writers. And sure enough, the ancient medical writers like Hippocrates or Galen, Celsus, some of these other figures, they have ideas about what we would call mental illness. But if you go to the ancient philosophers, they have far more to say about it. And then again, if you go to, say, the Greek tragedians, they have all the same behaviors and attitudes and so on display, and they have yet another way of characterizing all these things.
And I guess you have the terminology for mental illness, but surely we can see examples of what we would now deem mental illness, particularly in, say, Greek tragedy. You think of a character like Medea or Clytemnestra. These would be people we would definitely describe as having mental illness with today's terminology.
Well, so that's really what I'm interested in, right? Is Medea is the perfect example there, isn't she? With Medea, she's the classic case of the mother that you see today in the news periodically who murders her own children for various reasons. Now, if you read Euripides' play, the question is, why does she do it? And she's not doing it as Euripides creates her because of some chemical imbalance. She's not doing it because of some lesion in the brain or some broken brain, which is how some people tend to think of it today. She has reasons rather than causes for her behavior. Just for the listeners, right? I mean, typically we ought to be describing goal-directed behavior as having reasons. You know, I drink a cup of coffee for a reason. I don't drink it because I'm caused to do it the way I would be caused to have a seizure if I have epilepsy, or I would be caused to fall down if you pushed me. But when you get to the category of mental illness in the modern world, within the realm of psychiatry, this is typically the very explanation for why people do heinous things or why they're unhappy. They say, well, my body is causing me to feel this way, or I'm hearing voices that are causing me to commit murder, and so on. And so I find that very interesting that within the world that, say, Euripides creates of the Medea, it's perfectly understandable why she does these things. You know, she's an immigrant brought to a new community and promptly discarded, abandoned by her husband, left with no resources. Meanwhile, the husband takes up with another woman. And she's completely desperate. These are the things she says in her long speech. I'm desperate. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. You bring me here. You abandon me. I have these kids. And so to exact revenge, this is not to endorse what she does, but it's certainly understandable, I think, or many readers think so.
Now, of course, we might also say this is indicative of Euripides' mind, because in the original mythology of Medea, she doesn't kill her children, and Euripides has made her a little bit more tragic than the mythology that you see in Corinth.
Absolutely. I think that's an excellent point. So why was Euripides interested in recreating Medea from this old tradition into the character that's so memorable that we know where she murders her children? And I would guess, I don't think we have any real evidence for this, but I would guess it's because he saw within his own society women who committed these acts of murdering their kids. You know, why does he create Heracles, I should say, in the Heracles, in that tragedy? Heracles is a combat veteran. He returns home and he shoots his family. Again, these are things that we see about with returning combat veterans. Nowadays, people would say, well, they have PTSD. They used to say they had battle fatigue, something like that. But what's interesting is the reactions we have today. When someone does those things, if we don't put them in prison, we tend to commit them to a mental hospital and give them drugs that are called medicine. And when you call the drugs medicine, people assume they're medicating a problem within the body rather than, you might say, a problem in that person's life.
And this sort of relates to some other things I've read that you've written and have spoken about the kind of parallel understanding of the mental illness in the ancient world stemming from Hippocrates' beliefs in the medical world versus Epicurus' philosophies.
Yes, that's the distinction I find so fascinating. It's one of the things we're arguing about today, right? So if someone goes to a therapist, the therapist with a problem, say I'm unhappy at home, and the therapist concludes, well, you have depression, then they will recommend two courses of treatment, typically, right? One would either be drugs, you know, medicines to inhibit serotonin or something like that, or they would recommend talk therapy, or sometimes both. And that's exactly what's happening in the ancient world. If you go to Hippocrates or you go to some of these other doctors in the ancient world, they have a drug back then called hellebore that they would give you to try and knock out your unhappiness. Or you could go to the philosophers who would say, you know, what's wrong with your life? If you went to Epicurus, he would say, well, it's because you're afraid of death, whether you're thinking about it consciously or it's always on your mind or it's just... Yeah, as you get older, you're always worried about the process of dying and being dead and leaving behind everything you love. And that's what's driving your anxiety. And so, of course, Epicurus decides to come up with a whole philosophy on how to change your mind and say, well, there's no hell to be afraid of when you die. So you need to get that thought out of your mind. And once that anxiety dissipates, you will learn to reevaluate what you have here in this world. And that will start making the problems in your life go away.
Sometimes easier said than done, granted.
Oh, I don't, it's certainly not easy, is it? And it's also not clear that telling people there's no life after death will make them happy. Epicurus was sure that was true, and Lucretius was sure that was true, and many, many Epicureans were sure that was true. But as you can tell by looking around the world today, there are many more people, certainly here in the United States, that believe in life after death than there are Epicureans or atheists, for that matter.
Well, and some of the problems you have with Epicurus and Lucretius as well is that it doesn't necessarily address the fear we might have of leaving people behind, because even if they say, well, don't worry, you won't worry about them once you're dead, you can worry about it before you're dead, and that can cause stress and anxiety in your life.
I agree with you. I think that's one of the points, certainly in Lucretius. Everybody gets to this passage. I think it's in the end of book three, maybe at the beginning of book four, where he sort of ridicules the lament of, oh, when you're gone, you won't hear your children any longer, and so on. You won't hear the tears for you. And he says, don't be a fool. You won't be around. That's impossible. But everybody says, but hang on, I'm thinking about that stuff right now. And so I agree, that is one of the toughest parts of the entire thing. It's interesting, that's why Lucretius, I think, structures the De Rerum Natura in the fashion that he does. He starts with physics, you know, atoms moving around in the void, and tries to build up to what is probably the weakest point in saying you need to stop worrying about dying, rather than leading with that point about, well, there's no life after death. So if you can go along with him that far into the philosophy, sometimes people are convinced. Usually they're not so convinced. But it is interesting that he says that is the source of anxiety, and that is why people are unhappy. It's not because of imbalances. A point that I've made in a few things that I've written, and I've spoken to psychiatrists about this who are sort of interested, is that in the ancient world, as you know, the predominant theory wasn't cellular lesions that were causing diseases. It was imbalance of the humors, right? This, I'm sure you're familiar with this, right? So the black bile and the white bile and the yellow bile, and they all get out of whack. But this is, so that idea was completely discarded in the 19th century for the disease model, which is now completely predicated, not except in the realm of mental illness, but in every other domain of medicine is predicated on lesions of the body, typically of the cells. And yet it snuck back in the door with the idea of chemical imbalances for mental illness.
Yeah, we can't seem to shake the humors. I actually just saw, I think it was like a New York Times article recently saying about how the understanding the four humors could help you figure out how to work better in the workplace. And I was like, oh no, it's coming back again still.
It's getting trendy. Well, one thing that I think is, certainly, the medical record speaks for itself that our current model is better than what they had back then. But one risk we do have, and I think we run a lot these days, is reducing things too much, right? So this is how Epicurus goes to try and attack your fear of death. He takes you literally down to the atomic level to explain the way the universe works. And sometimes when you go that far down, you reduce things. You miss all the forest for the trees that make it up. And so it would be interesting. Right? I mean, right now, nutrition... and all these fad diets and things are based on sort of microscopic examinations of the components of food rather than the holistic idea of, you know, eating the carrot as opposed to chopping it up and straining out everything except the one vitamin that we think is helpful for us.
Yeah, I think taking a step back can be very helpful at times personally.
Yeah.
Now, I was thinking another extreme of mental illness that today we think of immediately as sort of the end point of extreme mental illness, but had very different understanding and implications in the ancient world, is the concept of suicide. That today we just sort of assume that that's obviously a negative thing at the very end of pain and suffering. But obviously in the ancient Greek and even more so in the ancient Roman world, suicide wasn't seen that way.
Well, so yeah, of course, this is a really difficult topic, and I want to try and be as, you know, sensitive as I can about it. Suicide is tough. Within the realm of psychiatry, it is typically characterized as the end point of mental illness. But again, that gets to the idea that you somehow suicide is caused rather than has reasons for it. I mean, people leave suicide notes and they explain their thinking. A friend of mine, when he was 92 years old, he had written several books on the right to death, as he called it, or the right to a dignified suicide. And so when he was 92 years old, he fell at home and broke his back. And the doctor said, well, we're going to operate immediately. And he said, don't be absurd. And he went home and he took his life with a bottle of barbiturates. And, you know, people were aghast and they said, oh, he was crazy. But other people said, well, here was a man who said, he always said his whole life he wanted to choose his time of death. And that his highest value was not life itself, but quality of life. And so it gets a bit tricky if you take suicide, if you regard it as a sort of a species of mental illness, it gets very tricky when you get to someone that, you know, they describe why they're making this terrible choice for themselves, and it makes sense to us. I don't know if you would agree with that.
Well, I just think it's interesting looking at the Latin, and I know you're a much better expert at Latin than myself, but that there was essentially two different terms as well, that suicidium, as we would think of it today, I mean, didn't even exist in the Latin. I mean, they would have assumed you were talking about pigs, whereas the actual word was mors voluntaria. And, you know, as you said, the concept of reasons and causes were made all the difference about whether it was sort of honorable or not honorable, as well as the methods used.
That's right. So I haven't looked in a while. I believe the phrase in Latin, the idiom is mortem sibi conscisci, sort of a strange thing. It means to take your own life. the cases we're most familiar with, and I'm sure the listeners can be most familiar with, are the suicides that were compelled under the early Roman emperors, the Julio-Claudians, right? And those are tough because they're sort of suicide under duress. They're like the Socrates suicide where the state comes along and they say, well, you can take your own life and your children will inherit your property, or we can execute you. And they won't. And so that, you know, so Seneca committed suicide under these terms, we're told. Petronius committed suicide under these terms. It's kind of tough to call that suicide in the same way that I think we were talking about just a couple of minutes ago. But one of the problems these philosophies in the ancient world do tend to lead to is, for example, with Epicureanism, if you're not supposed to be afraid of death, then why not take your own life? And it's a really tough argument. We were thinking about this in a course I taught for some alumni here last week at Cornell, and I was trying to illustrate this through the song Don't Fear the Reaper. Do you know this song by the Blue Oyster Cult?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And it actually, the Blue Oyster Cult song, so I'm going to challenge your listeners to find the similarities between Don't Fear the Reaper, Catullus's first poem to Lesbia, where he says, let us live, my Lesbia, and let us love. That's Catullus 5. And then Horace's Ode 111, which is the famous one to Laocoonte, where he says, seize the day. So those first two poems are definitely Epicurean poems. These are guys trying to seduce women. They said, don't worry about your reputation. It doesn't matter what's going to come in the future. We got to live in the moment and so on. And so it turns out Don't Fear the Reaper is meant to be the same thing. The guy who wrote the song said it's supposed to be a love song about, you know, seizing the day and so on. And everyone immediately assumed that it was a like a call to bring death about. So I find it very striking when you put all these things together, how we think about suicide, how we think about death, how we think about pleasure, how we think about mental illness.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. I guess I was thinking about the Seneca quote, which is, if I recall correctly, it's somewhere along the lines of, sometimes to live is an act of courage.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think most of us can affirm that one. It's very difficult, especially, you know, in circumstances where you have no political freedom, as Seneca did, or where, you know, you're living in an increasingly autocratic regime. That would be very difficult. But there's a million circumstances that spring to my mind about when life can be a little tough. But hopefully, you know, so Epicurus's solution to all this, Lucretius's solution, was to form communities. That's one of the most interesting things about, to my mind, about Epicurus himself, was coming up with a philosophy that seems to be the intellectual godfather of Epicureanism, of libertarianism. And yet, instead of just casting everybody out and say, well, now you have this philosophy, go sink or swim, he formed these communities where he had people sign loyalty oaths to become members. The garden seems to be something like a hippie commune in Athens, where everybody would go, and they have abandoned the temples and the churches and the state religions, and they try to create their own meaning in these new communities that form specifically for the purpose of propping each other up.
Is this like an ancient Galt's Gulch?
An ancient, say that again?
An ancient Galt's Gulch.
What is that? Maybe I don't know.
Galt. Who is John Galt? You know, Ayn Rand.
Sure, yeah. But I haven't seen it. Boy, I haven't read Rand in a very long time, so I'm missing the reference.
Well, I was just thinking about, you know, the libertarian community and, you know, who is John Galt is usually a common sort of slogan to throw about, and that the concept in Atlas Shrugged is that, you know, up in the mountains away from the downfall of the overly bureaucratic government and state is this free living community that has their own rules and where they live more independently.
Yeah, that is, as far as we can tell, that was what the Epicureans were calling for, right? They say, Lucretius has a beautiful part about this at the beginning of book two, where he says, you need to shun politics, stay out of the limelight. It's not going to make you happy. It's just going to make you miserable. And the image he has there at the beginning of book two is, he says, you know, sometimes you look out at the Mediterranean Sea and you see some guy drowning and you think, oh, that's pleasant. It's very strange. You say, that's not pleasant. That's horrible. This guy's dying. And he says, you know, you realize that that you're not involved with what's going on out there, and so you have this sort of serenity by stepping back. And then he just as you're sort of freaked out by this image, then he says, well, you know, it's not so different from when you're sitting on top of a hill and you see two armies clashing in battle and all these people killing each other, and you think, well, I don't have anything to do with that. So he says, you should stay out of politics. You shouldn't run for office. You should just sort of enjoy life away from all that sort of thing.
And then Pericles would come along and say something along the lines of, well, just because you don't take an interest in politics doesn't mean it doesn't take an interest in you.
It's true. And then, of course, there's also the gap between, you know, the creed and the behavior, right? So we know some of the most famous Epicureans were heavily involved in politics. One of the assassins of Julius Caesar, Cassius, was an Epicurean. That doesn't seem to fit with the furniture. Julius Caesar himself seems to have been an Epicurean, or he looks like one if you read Sallust. If you go to Sallust's War of Catiline, I think it's chapter 51, there's a long speech of Julius Caesar. And he says death is the end point. There's nothing after that. And yet here's Julius Caesar. I mean, he's doing the very opposite of staying out of the limelight. He's seizing the day in politics.
And so the kind of the concepts of Epicurus philosophy versus Hippocrates' belief in the body and addressing the body for issues, what do you think the sort of modern implications of those kind of parallel contrasting philosophies are?
So between Platonism and Epicureanism, is that
you're asking us?
The Hippocratic method.
Hippocrates. I misheard you. I thought you said Socrates. So so that would be exactly the difference between a psychiatrist and a priest nowadays, as far as I can tell. So if you go, the Hippocratic doctors, they look to the bodies for all the things that are wrong with you. And it's like the cliche, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So if you go to a Hippocratic doctor with a broken arm, that's the right person, right? Then the person will set your arm and it will heal and so on. But if you go to the Hippocratic doctor and you complain that you're unhappy or you can't get off the sofa or that you're hearing voices and so on, the Hippocratic doctor is going to assume you have a brain disease. This is typically the model we're familiar with in psychiatry today. You have a broken brain or a chemical imbalance of some kind. And, of course, we don't diagnose mental illnesses. By definition, mental illnesses are not diagnosed by examining the brain. They're just diagnosed by talking to somebody and asking what the problems are. Whereas if you were to go to a religious figure, a priest, a rabbi, an imam, in different traditions, then they're going to tell you that you have sort of a spiritual ailment, which is sort of a fancy metaphor for saying you've got something wrong in your life. And so that's why Plautus's Menaechmi, I wrote a paper about this some years ago, and in the play Plautus's Menaechmi, this is exactly the issue that is being debated at the center of the play. There, do you know the play, the Menaechmi?
I'm not very familiar with it.
Oh, you got to go get a copy. It's fantastic. So it is the inspiration for Shakespeare's Comedy of Errors, and it involves two twins, identical twins, that are separated at birth, and they're raised apart. And you flash forward about, I don't know, 25, 30 years, and one of them goes out looking for the other. And in the meantime, it so happened that they both have the same name. So the day of the play, the newcomer, the one twin, shows up in the hometown of the other, and they keep missing each other, but of course everybody knows their name, and they keep mistaking the guy who's just arrived for the guy who lives in town, and they can't figure out why he's acting so strange, and everything seems wrong and unfamiliar, and he gets quite emotional. He gets accused of adultery by a woman who thinks that this guy is her husband, and so they summon a Hippocratic doctor who comes in, and the doctor diagnoses in Hippocratic form. He diagnoses this total stranger as having a mental illness, and he says, I'm going to give you hellebore that will knock, you know, this illness right out of your body. And the guy says, I don't want to take any of your drugs. And so the doctor calls in strong guys to come and forcibly restrain this guy, and they're going to drug him against his will. Now, this is actually quite serious, but that's not so different from what can happen in situations nowadays. It's, I think, the rule rather than the exception that people, they don't want to take strong drugs against their, I mean, they're often given drugs and they say, well, there's nothing wrong with me. And so in psychiatry, that can be called the lack of insight, right? So-and-so doesn't know that he has a mental illness or she's got a mental illness. So for their own good, we're going to give them this medicine and it's going to make them better. And so it's coded in a form of paternalism. And I think it's debatable whether we should debate whether that's a good idea in some cases, a bad idea in other cases.
Yes, I always think that the spectrum of what is considered normal, healthy, or positive human behavior may have narrowed over the centuries, and that we might not see the value of people who maybe exist mentally a more extreme places on that spectrum. That if it's just considered be normal behavior or not normal, but what is normal? I mean, we're defining something within a certain realm as being normal or not.
Absolutely, right? Yes. And so if normal is just a social agreement, that's what Epicurus would say. It's all just a convention. We've all just agreed that this is normal. Then deviation from it would be social in origin, right? But if it's medical, right, that is, say, if it's like height, if you measure, most people are, 5'9", and then so-and-so is 2 feet tall, you say, well, there's something going on there. That's not social in origin. So when you take sort of unhappiness or distress or high emotion out of the realm of things that can be objectively measured, and they have to be measured subjectively, you're absolutely right that these things move all around. So when Europe was more or less completely Christian 500 years ago, they didn't have mental illness back then either. They had sin, and they had heresy. And a lot of the behaviors that we're familiar with today would have been characterized as one or the other.
Now, in 2016, you won the Thomas S. Sowers Award for Outstanding Contributions to the Cause of Civil Liberties. Could you tell me a little bit about that and why you won that award?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, sure. So Thomas Sowers was a very famous renegade psychiatrist. He wrote many, many books, I don't know, 30 or 40 of them, and I don't know, 500 or 1,000 articles, all about psychiatry. And he, as a practicing academic psychiatrist, he went into the field in order to discredit its premises. And he said that this stuff is all social in origin. It's all personal in origin. It's politics. It's economics. It's not cellular diseases and that sort of thing. So he dedicated his career to discrediting the biological basis of mental illness. And then he had a whole bunch of other ideas about what we should do if we if he can convince us that it's not medical in origin, but it's social or personal in origin, then what do we do about it? What are the policies? And so when Sowers took his life in 2012, or before he had, they'd established these awards for people that wrote articles or books or made activist contributions sort of in the same spirit. And in 2016, I won the award for this article I wrote about comparing. It was on the basis of several articles. One was about the Menichmi. The one that I mentioned earlier, comparing the Menichmi to a famous study, you would say, called the Rosenhan experiment, where I saw the basic similarities between this 1973 psychology study done in Stanford and this ancient play from 2,300 years ago. So I compared those, and Sowers himself was still alive then, and he thought that this made fantastic sense and so on. And then I wrote a number of other articles when Sowers took his life. I compared him, I went to the annual meeting of the American Psychiatric Association, and I said, well, nobody at this entire gigantic meeting is talking about this sort of giant of the field who's no longer here. So I said, I'm going to compare why his policies and ideas have completely failed with why Epicureanism, which is so superficially at least similar, was a great success for 6 or 7 or 8 centuries in the ancient world. And what was very interesting about that, I subsequently published that piece. It's up on a website called madinamerica.com, was that at the meeting, which is there may be 50 or 60 psychiatrists in the room, when it was over, half of them came up to me and they said, yeah, we think Sowers was right, but we just don't say so publicly.
That's amazing. I'm going to put links for our listeners to both your article in Mad in America, as well as to the Rosenhan experiment, sane and insane places, which you referenced as well, so they can follow up on those.
A terrific thing. And let me tell you, and there's, I can send you a link if you don't have it, to another piece. So just last year, we did a book in honor of Saas, so a Festschrift to honor sort of his work. And most of the writers were from medicine or psychiatry and other fields, but they asked me to contribute a paper. So I wrote a paper about the libation bearers of Aeschylus, sort of interpreting the libation bearers specifically from a Saasian point of view. And so just to remind listeners, if they aren't familiar, it's the second play in Aeschylus' trilogy, the Oresteia. And it begins with Orestes returning home, sort of the, you know, the return of the Jedi sort of thing. Orestes returns home. He's grown up, and he has come back to kill his mother. He recognizes and is recognized by his sister, and he, as the play goes on, he penetrates the palace defenses. He gets in, he kills the Gistus, and then his mother, Clytemnestra, comes out, and she first pleads and says, "How can you do this? I'm your own mother. I raised you," and so on. And he hesitates for a moment, but then he decides to kill her anyway. And he does, in the moment that he does strike her down and murder her, he's immediately haunted by these furies. He says, "I can see these demons rising up, and they're frightening me, and they're chasing me, and I've got to get away." And he's got this friend there, Pylades, who says, "Nah, that stuff's not real," or the chorus is saying, "That stuff's not real, it's all in your head." And he says, "I got to go, get out of here." And that's the end of the play. Extremely dramatic. It's probably the best of all the Greek tragedies in terms of suspense and drama. Now, of course, in the third play, the Eumenides, it does emerge in that play, which is a later play, that the Furies really are sort of supernatural beings. But that's certainly not clear within the libation bearers itself. And so as I'm reading this play again, it was quite interesting to say, well, what if Orestes, in other words, he is sort of what you would call a paranoid schizophrenic. I mean, he meets all the clinical symptoms of what until very recently was called paranoid schizophrenia. The DSM, the big book of diagnoses, has recently gotten rid of this subtype. Now they just call it all schizophrenia. But the guy meets the characteristics impeccably, and perhaps most impressively is that he seems to be hearing the oracle speaking to him in real time. And I said, "Yeah, boy, this is really like these people that show up in the news or in the neighborhood, and they say, oh, the FBI is after me, and they're communicating through my dental fillings." There's a fancy word for this. They call it like an influencing machine or something. But apparently this idea goes all the way back. And so the idea that I had in this paper was that Orestes seems to be one of these people that has motivated reasons for hearing the voices, motivated reasons for murdering his mother and so on, rather than, you know, some manifestation of a broken brain or simply a supernatural interpretation where he's being driven to do this by the oracle and he has no choice.
Sort of like the phrase, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. But all this gets back, you know, to the question of what we loosely call free will. It might be better simply to say choice, right? I mean, do we actually have choices or do we not have choices? And so if you go to read The Libation Bearers, if you think the Furies are real, well, then this guy doesn't have much choice. He's just a slave to the oracle. He can only do what it tells him to do. But, you know, if you read the play carefully and kind of look at his character, he seems to have multiple motivations for doing what he says. It's quite interesting.
And then, of course, it's also interesting to think that once again, once Euripides got his hands on the same story, he made Electra quite the gruesome murderer as well.
Absolutely, yes. And so you get yet another interpretation in Euripides. And there, it's even clearer, I think, that Orestes, he's like lying in sickbed. He would be sort of, I assume, someone who would have been confined against his will into, they didn't have psychiatric wards, but something like that in a confined unit. What I've always found interesting about Electra is that we don't have an Electra complex, right? We have this Oedipus complex. I'm sorry, we do have the Electra complex, but we don't have the Orestes complex. Electra, sorry, that's what I meant to say, even though Orestes would be the paranoid schizophrenic. But Electra seems to have her own reasons as well for this murder. You know, she's been raised in poverty. In Euripides, she's married to this guy she doesn't really want to be married to and so on. And so the playwrights are giving us reasons for murder. And in the context of American law, we have the concept of the insanity defense, which is to say you were so overridden by, I don't know, a broken brain or emotion, or you're not responsible for murder. And the playwrights don't like that idea at all. So they have to, you know, they start at the end point that these two kids murder their mom, and then they have to go back and figure out why that would make sense. I'm fascinated by these ideas.
Yeah, and I'm always fascinated, too, just by the modern justice system, because we currently give more leniency for crimes of passion with this insanity sort of clause. But it's very unjust in a way, because you, I don't want to say just murders, but for instance, if you have a domestic violence dispute and the man out of passion murders the wife, he will get a lesser treatment than if a woman meticulously plans to murder an abusive husband.
I agree with you completely. I mean, certainly throughout history, women have gotten the short end of the stick when it comes to these diagnoses or being called crazy and so on. But that you're exactly right. As a matter of law, there's a big split there. And it's also interesting. I was speaking in a psychiatry department a couple of years ago talking about arrestees. And I asked them, I said, you know, I see periodically, I Google it, or I see it periodically, you know, the insanity defense is at least attempted and sometimes granted for murder. But I've never seen it attempted or granted for rape. And I said, have you ever in your career seen that? And one guy said, yeah, only once in my entire career, and it didn't work. And I said, well, why do you think that is? That people were willing to credit it for murder, but nobody's willing to credit it for sexual assault. And they didn't have a good answer. But I wonder about that myself.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And now, if you will bear with me, if you have a few more moments, I'd love to take a turn from the sort of tragic and dark realm that we've been speaking of which, and sort of speak a bit about Roman comedy, which you are also quite versed in. You've been translating and working with Roman comedy for a while.
That's right. Yes, I just absolutely love comedy. I love the ancient comedy, and I love the playwright Plautus in particular. It goes all the way back to my I guess my undergraduate days, but I wrote a dissertation on puns in Plautus, and then subsequently a book that that changed my mind on everything I wrote in that dissertation. But I think the book is probably the right way to go. And subsequently, I read through the plays periodically and always seeing new things. And my main goal in all of these things is to try and excavate the jokes. And I'm sure that there are more jokes there that we have missed, in particular because the scribes in the Middle Ages, I'm sure when they saw a play on words, and if they just didn't, if a play on words occurred in the text and they sort of didn't get the joke, they thought it was a misspelled word. And so they thought they were correcting a mistake, but by doing that, they would sort of auto-correct, like on your iPhone, and they would get rid of the best part. And so I've written a number of articles trying to say that, you know, the circumstantial evidence looks pretty convincing that this sort of benign verse that doesn't really seem to say anything funny could be hysterical if we just sort of change one letter. And some people agree and other people don't. But I keep at it nevertheless, because I think the jokes are, some of them are hilarious. I love this stuff.
But it's got to be quite difficult translating ancient comedy, because, I mean, not only do you have, obviously, the linguistic difficulties, but also with regards to context. I mean, a lot of Aristophanes' jokes, for instance, are really only funny if you know all the people he's referencing, the current social climate. I mean, the role of comedy often is to make fun of those in power and the current societal situation. So, I mean, how much context do you have to teach people in order for them to get the joke?
Oh, that's a great point. So if you are reading Aristophanes, you are absolutely right. Aristophanes needs footnotes on every single page. Because it's sort of like watching The Daily Show. It's all contemporary political satire, and we don't know who most of these people were. When you get to the so-called new comedy, which is what I've written most about, starting with Menander and a bunch of other playwrights that only exist in fragments, all of that goes away and you start getting really just exportable situations. And so they become much more like sitcoms where the, you know, it's sort of set in a vaguely contemporary setting, but it could still be funny 10 or 20 or 30 years later. It could still be funny halfway around the world. And it seems pretty clear that that happens for the same reason it happens today. So after right around the time this guy Menander died in Athens, the entirety of comedy moved on from Athens to an integrated circuit all around the Mediterranean. It was coordinated. And so these groups of actors would go around performing classics from the Greek stage in all around the Mediterranean. And in Rome itself, we get this one strange variation where they were translating and adapting them into Latin and setting them to music. So when you get to Plautus and Terence, we have 26 and change of these plays. You're getting sort of Broadway musical versions in Latin of these Greek sitcoms, for lack of a better word. And so those pretty clearly do seem to be universal. When you read Plautus, people still laugh pretty hard today.
Now, this might be a bit of a controversial statement to say to somebody who has already admitted that they're quite a fan of Roman comedy, but could it be argued that Roman comedy, that Plautus and Terence are essentially just translators of Greek comedies?
Well, it's funny that you ask me that, because I do think they definitely do translate, but you could make the same accusation in those terms of everything about ancient Rome, right? We hear that a lot, that they're just sort of translating and copying the Greek originals. You know, Virgil's imitating the Iliad, or the Roman statues are just these marble cuts of the bronze originals and so on. But what's really strange is that in all of, we have a lot of Greek comic fragments, and we have a lot of Plautus and Terence, and there's only a teeny tiny handful of places where you can definitely show that the Latin is translating the Greek. And so it could just be the case that we don't have any of the originals. But it seems much more likely the case that they thoroughly reworked these plays in the process of creating something new. And what gets interesting there, in Plautus anyway, is that we can prove that. There's a famous papyrus that was discovered or sort of identified in the late 60s called the Disexapeton of Menander, the Double Deceiver. And we have the play that corresponds to by Plautus, the Bacchides, which is sort of the two Bacchus sisters. And you can line up the papyrus with the parts of the play, and you can see exactly where Plautus cut some of the monologues. He wrote some new monologues to go in. He cut a character, reduced a character. And again, you can do a little bit of this with a play called the Kistelaria of Plautus, where we have the original of a few of the lines and sort of the beginning in Menander's Greek. But there's another point to make that I probably should have said before, and I think it's a point that a lot of us are getting really interested in, is why did these playwrights select these particular plays? If you go to read Plautus, there's a lot of just sort of screwball comedy. But when you go to Terence, most of the plots, and a good number of Plautuses, they center around a sexual assault. And certainly in Terence, there's one, the eunuch, where the sexual assault takes place off stage in real time, notionally. And so it's sort of like Ovid. He's got all these awful accounts in the Metamorphoses of a rape. And you say, well, why are these people writing about this stuff? And some people say, well, that's because they like it, or this is what's in the original. And other people are saying, well, that might not be the case. These things, maybe they want to problematize women's rights in Athens, which don't seem to have been very extensive. Or maybe they want to problematize politics, and they're using rape for a metaphor and so on. So this, I think, is where some of the most interesting and innovative scholarship is coming out on Roman comedy right now. I don't really do any of this myself, but Sharon James at UNC has written influentially very good stuff about some of these interpretations of Roman comedy and what we can glean from it.
Yeah, I think in many ways, comedy is a more accurate reflection of the society, of people's beliefs and ideas, whereas maybe tragedy tries to tap into more universal, deeply held beliefs. They kind of play very different roles in what we want to understand in the ancient world.
I agree with you, and it brings me to a point that I find really interesting, because I tend to read some of this with students, and I say, if we're reading these plays, and if this is a more or less accurate reflection of Athens in the Hellenistic period. What are the status of women? These women are not allowed outdoors without a male chaperone. They have a word, kyrios, the sort of, you know, the lord or the gentleman, I guess, that keeps an eye on them. So it usually has to be a male relative. The women are routinely being assaulted and you know, their voice is usually silenced and so on. It doesn't look very good. It certainly doesn't match the Periclean ideal of, you know, beacon of freedom and so on. So it can be a fascinating way of trying to get into Greek society in a way that we can't really get a whole lot of access to in other ways.
Yeah, and very fascinating. Now, just to finish up, would you be able to tell our listeners a little bit about what you're working on at the moment?
Right now, thank you. I've got two books in press, and I'm excited about both of them. One should be out in just a couple of months, and it's called The Pig War. Both of these books are Renaissance poems for Renaissance Germany. Neither has been translated before. And so I've done bilingual editions, Latin and English. The Pig War is going to be absolutely fantastic because every single word in this poem begins with the letter P. So they're Latin hexameters, about 240 of them, and a preface and some comments on the end. And every single word in the book begins with the letter P. So it's hilarious and strange all by itself that this can even be done, that a whole story can be written with no other words. But when I finally puzzled out what was going on, it's the story of the corrupt hogs who are hogging all the privileges and the young piglets who want to get some of those privileges for themselves. And it devolves into an open war. And so it's sort of this civil war among the pigs. And it's interesting because, you know, they're all citing privilege and oppression back and forth. But it also seems very reminiscent of George Orwell's Animal Farm. And so I've been digging around and trying to figure out if Orwell knew it, and I can't prove that he did. I've shown it to a few experts who say it certainly seems plausible. So I'm hoping that I can bring the ball sort of up to a certain point and somebody else who's more expert will pick it up and run with it. But the book will be coming out from the Paideia Institute Press, and it's going to have illustrations. I've been teamed up with this amazingly talented young graphic artist who's done all these pen and ink drawings to go with it. So we're hoping it'll be sort of a gift book for people who love Latin.
Oh, that sounds very exciting. I look forward to seeing it myself, and I can put some notes down below as well for listeners to find out more about that. I think this is about the time to say thank you so much for talking to me today and to explain a bit of the very interesting topics of mental illness in the ancient world and Roman comedy.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure.